get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Peace and much love to you. Peace. Hey, Paul.
Hey. Good to see you guys. I missed you so much.
You too. We was away, but I'm glad we're back.
You're too busy. You need to make sure. And Grant's moved on. And
he's going to go to law school. I'm so excited for Grant.
Yeah.
He needs to anyway, because he's the right kind of people.
Yep. Yep. That's true. Anyway, that's a little inside baseball. Grant's been here helping get this thing on Facebook, which
we
weren't able
to.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he will at some point. But, yeah, I'm still sure you're still recuperating. Sorry I missed your event. I think I went to the rally, and it was close to when I got off the air and that kind of thing. So
yes, that's all right. We'll do another one next year, celebrating our women in our community.
Mm-hmm. I think my sister's working for Cori Bush in St. Louis, and she lives there. Okay, what do I got today? Well, I got John Nichols on the elections, a lot of him, with a favorite interviewer, Brian Edwards Tiekert. There are some things about the Mamdani victory that need to be analyzed. There's some particularities of New York, like public funding of campaigns and the ranked choice voting that happened at the primary level, where the Jewish candidate and Mamdani said, rank us together. So, yeah, I don't know how much that happened in the primary.
The ranked choice voting, Paul, would be good. I have looked at ranked choice voting a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
The one area that I found it to be very a very powerful argument is in presidential primaries.
Right.
Because I always go back to the 2024, maybe, whichever one where Bernie was leading and he was the head of the pack, and the sort of established Democrats decided to coalesce around Joe Biden, right? Well, if you were a voter who had cast your ballot already for Amy Klobuchar or Kamala Harris or someone, your vote was now... It didn't go anywhere. It just sort of went in the trash can, if you will, because you had already voted prior to election day. And so if these candidates, these presidential candidates drop out, your votes drop out. Well, ranked choice, you could say, well, if my candidate dropped out, please apply it to someone who's left in the race. Yeah.
Well, I call it instant runoff. I think, you know, mayor means majority in... a number of romance languages, and it seems to me that a mayor should have a majority. So, yeah, and instant runoff ensures that the person that got the most votes got the majority.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's not very complicated. I got Wole Soyinka, the famous Nigerian author scholar. He teaches at NYU in Abu Dhabi and was recently denied a permit to come here. There was a part two, and I think we should hear from him at least a little bit. But mainly can be taken up with John Nichols going into the details. One thing that I don't hear that often is that it wasn't, in the sense of a mandate, it was an overwhelming turnout. But he really won 50% of the vote, just over 50% of the vote. So if there'd been ranked choice in the general election, I bet you there had been a lot of lawyers and a lot of wrangling because it's possible that the guy that ran as an independent, as well as, I'm forgetting the name, Sliwe, the Guardian Angels group, if they ranked Cuomo second, it would have gotten even closer. But maybe they had revulsion against Cuomo too, and left their second choice blank, or maybe went with Mamdani. Who knows? And no Mumia Abu-Jamal this week. I hope he's doing well. He's having some health problems. I hope they're getting corrected. But, Amy Goodman's got a great commentary on the Mamdani thing, including a little history about Eugene Debs. which I'll announce now. I'm going for the long haul today. I've got Gus Wood is out in Pittsburgh doing labor education. So Stephanie and I are going to be, I'll be running the board and running my mouth a little bit. So that's coming up in an hour or so. But let's get started with Amy Goodman's commentary. Right now, I guess. Oh, well, let's see. Maybe I should read an underwriting because I got so engaged with the Ammons there that I didn't do my usual due diligence. So let's see. Plant Mode. Programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Plant Mode of Downtown Champaign since 2013. Wow. That has been providing the 217 Plant Gang with tropical succulent plants, planters, artwork, vinyl records. Oh, they have a record store, too. Local made woodworked items like plant stands, benches, cutting boards, rolling pins. Plant Mode now at 520 North Neal Street, right across from the post office. Updates daily on Instagram or on plantmode.com. Yeah, and they hosted a jazz event there, too, which would have been nice amongst the plants. Okay, got that taken care of. Let's start with Amy Goodman's commentary, which will probably frame the whole next 3 hours for me. Hope you can hang around for a bit of it.
Zoran Mamdani, Eugene V. Debs, and the Dawn. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Zoran Mamdani made history, winning the race to be the next mayor of New York City. The Democratic Socialist is the first Muslim and the first person of South Asian descent elected to lead the largest city in the United States. At 34 years old, he's the youngest elected to the office in over a century. His meteoric rise from a little-known state assembly member to his stunning upset on Tuesday has sent shockwaves through the Democratic Party. With over 100,000 volunteers and organizers, a savvy social media presence, and a platform to make New York affordable, Zoran Mamdani charted a path to victory, defeating the state's disgraced former governor, Andrew Cuomo. At his victory party at the Brooklyn Paramount late Tuesday night, Mamdani was welcomed on stage by a cheering crowd of jubilant supporters. He opened his rousing speech saying,
"The sun may have set over our city this evening, but as Eugene Debs once said, I can see the dawn of a better day for humanity."
Quoting one of the most famous socialists in U.S. history, Eugene V. Debs was born to immigrant parents on November 5, 1855. He started working at 14, laboring on the railroads, becoming a fireman, shoveling coal on steam-powered locomotives. He joined the Firemen's Union, rising in the ranks. He then formed the American Railway Union, ARU, to organize all railway industry workers, including, he hoped, women and African Americans. The ARU struck against the Pullman Company, owned by George Pullman, who built and operated a massive fleet of luxury railroad sleeper cars, amassing a fortune while keeping his workers in near indentured status in his company town of Pullman, Illinois. The strike went national, hobbling the rail industry. President William Howard Taft called in the military, violently breaking the strike, killing over 30 strikers. As the public face of the strike, Eugene V. Debs was targeted for prosecution. He was convicted and sentenced to 6 months in a county jail. As he read and wrote in his cell, Debs became more radicalized and left jail a committed socialist. By 1900, he ran as the Socialist Party's candidate for president, the first of five such runs. In 1905, he co-founded the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, seeking to organize workers across industries into one big union. During his presidential run in 1912, he built so much momentum that establishment candidates like Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt were seriously concerned he could win. After the U.S. entered World War I, patriotic fervor swept the nation. Congress passed the Espionage Act in 1917, then the Sedition Act in 1918, making it a crime to speak out against the war. Despite this, Deb spoke at an outdoor mass meeting in Canton, Ohio, criticizing the war. No known recordings of Deb's voice exist, but actor Tim Robbins read the speech in a 2009 performance of Voices of the People's History of the United States, produced by Anthony Arnov and the late historian Howard Zinn.
Every solitary one of these aristocratic conspirators and would-be murderers claims to be an arch patriot. Every one of them insists that the war is being waged to make the world safe for democracy. What humbug. What rot. What false pretense. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder.
Debs was arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years in prison. His address to the court at sentencing on September 18, 1918, is considered one of the most eloquent speeches in modern English. That's the speech Mamdani quoted from. Debs concluded with perhaps his most famous words, performed at a different Voices event by actor David Strathairn.
That while there is a lower class, I am in it. And while there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free.
Eugene V. Debs served 3 years in federal prison, running his final presidential campaign in 1920 from his cell. New York City Mayor-elect Soran Mamdani chooses his words carefully. In quoting Eugene Debs, he not only signaled his democratic socialist beliefs, he was issuing a call to action. Like Debs, Mamdani understands, and his campaign embodied, that the struggle for justice requires mass organizing. President Donald Trump has threatened to punish New York City for electing Mamdani by cutting off federal funds. Like President Taft, Trump has deployed the military to several cities and promises more. Mamdani replied to Trump in his speech with a challenge.
To get to any of us, you will have to get through all of us.
He went on.
New York will remain a city of immigrants, a city built by immigrants, powered by immigrants. And as of tonight, led by an immigrant.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
What a resource going through the audio from those Voices of People's History. Amy Goodman was in St. Louis area twice, was screening the film, I believe, is what she's mainly doing. But the film is called, it's about about Democracy Now, which includes a lot of people, not just her. Take this story, please, or steal this story, please, I believe might be the idea of breaking through the limits of allowable debate. Which is an old Chomskyan phrase, which I should repeat more often since this is news from Neptune. I'll tell that story another time. But let's see. John Nichols on the election. Wanted to mention Eugene Debs' birthday was November 5th, 1855. Might be playing a little labor history in 2 minutes. Something that Stephanie Furtado used to do in Chicagoland. I'll get her talking about that a little bit. But interesting ones that came up in the last 4 days. Debs on birthday, and then Lincoln as a labor advocate. So, yeah, he actually was opposed to slavery because it undercut free labor, white labor, in a lot of ways. Maybe that evolved. Okay, part one and part two of election results from John Nichols, who is Washington editor of The Nation. His partner, Lisa Graves, was on Democracy Now!, notably talking about the extreme court. That's my name for the group. And it seems entirely appropriate. Seems like they might be clipping Trump's wings and making them do a whole lot of other paperwork to allow these retaliatory tariffs to go continue. And I'm sure they'll probably find a way to continue them while they're trying to fulfill the court ruling. Ha, that's a joke. So many court rulings are being I don't know what the right word is. Ignored is too weak, but yeah, they're being ignored, trampled upon. And yeah, there's another one about from Portland saying that, yeah, there's no cause for sending the National Guard to Portland. When will they be removed? Good question. All right, here's a long discourse, and it gets into fusion voting and the electoral funding system that New York City has. I don't know if it's throughout the state of New York. I don't think it is. I think this was where they have matching funds for smaller donations. A simple thing that could help. Not Mitch Jeserich. He's just retired from Letters in Politics. This is Brian Edwards Tiekert, great, great interviewer. I defer to him a lot.
Country. The headliner, of course, Zohran Mamdani, first Democratic Socialist who's going to be mayor of New York. But he didn't just like eke out a victory in a crowded race. He got more than 50% of the vote in a vote that had the biggest turnout in more than half a century in New York City. Reportedly, more than 100,000 volunteers working for his campaign, knocking on doors in the home stretch. If you look across the rest of the country, what you see is turnout up everywhere that voters saw a chance to give some kind of rebuff to the Trump administration. Mikki Sherrill, Democratic candidate for governor of New Jersey, wildly outperformed her polling, winning New Jersey governor by a 13-point margin in the results so far. In the state of Virginia, a perennial battleground state for both the Senate and the president, the Democrat Abigail Spanberger took the office by what looks like more than a 15-point margin. Democrats swept every statewide office on the ballot, unseated a Republican attorney general, made massive gains in the state house. And in other places where less prominent statewide offices were on the ballot, Democrats ran the table. This was the case for Supreme Court justices in the state of Pennsylvania. It was the case for the crucial battleground state of Georgia, where Democrats took two seats on the Public Service Commission, which regulates things like electricity prices. Joining us to walk through it all and the implications, John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, Brian.
It's good to have you back with us, John. I want to start in New York because in many ways this is the exceptional race. Zohran Mamdani was not running against a stand-in for Donald Trump, at least not until the final couple days of the race when Trump endorsed former New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo. What do you make of the Mamdani phenomenon?
A lot. let's be honest. I think Zohran Mamdani, while he was really striving even to the end to make sure that his campaign was focused very locally and on very kind of core issues in New York City, became a national phenomenon. Remember, this is a candidate who, after his primary victory, was on the cover not just of The Nation, but of Time magazine. So people in the country were watching what was happening in New York, not least Donald Trump. And the interesting thing is that to the very end, Trump and the people around him threw everything they could into stopping Zohran Mamdani. And that wasn't just Trump's, outbursts on social media. It was also tens of millions of dollars spent by billionaires in New York City and elsewhere to, in many cases, simply smear Mamdani. And none of it worked. And that in itself is significant in the broader analysis that we'll be doing today of the pushback against Trump and Trumpism and the sort of billionaire class that has circled around him. But there's something else that we can't lose sight of. A year ago, at that time, 33-year-old immigrant from Uganda, who is Muslim, who is a proud democratic socialist, who is outspoken about Gaza and about a number of global and domestic issues that place him in a very boldly progressive, even radical stance, decided to run for mayor of New York City. He had about 1% support in the polls. He framed a campaign that was very different than Democrats have done in New York in the past, and frankly, than they've done almost anywhere. It was this kind of social media-driven, volunteer-driven, focused campaign that spoke directly to issues that were very practical in the lives of the voters, but very bold in their vision. Free buses, frozen rent, grocery stores and food deserts, a program to assure pre-K and child care. I mean, just, you know, a real bold social agenda, economic agenda. And he didn't just win. He won overwhelmingly throughout the city, a majority of the vote, and he did it on top of a massively boosted turnout. So that to find comparisons to this, you've got to go back to the 1960s. New York had some of its biggest elections with John Lindsay and people like that. Bottom line is, Mamdani is a phenomenon. He's a phenomenon in New York. He is a national phenomenon that tells the Democratic Party a great deal about what they can and should be doing.
There are a whole lot of people in the Democratic consultant class who would line up to tell a prospective candidate not to run on freezing rents, taxing the wealthy, and making the buses free.
Yes, you are right. And they would tell them, and they would also tell this candidate, don't go talking a whole lot about Gaza.
Mm. Which was an extraordinarily uncompromising position for the Mamdani campaign. Oops, it looks like we just dropped our connection to John Nichols. I'm going to ask my engineer to get him back on the line. This show is Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Taker. We are debriefing last night's rather stunning election results with John Nichols, the executive editor of The Nation. And while we are getting him back on the phone, I'll take you back in time, 6 years to when Zoran Mamdani was producing rap tracks known as Mr. Cardamom.
Best damn Donnie that you ever done, see. Off the top 5, Donnie Sam. Off the top 3, I'm the number 1, Donnie don't f*** with me. Off any of the Donnie says they better than Ravine. Cause I'm 85 years old, 85 years old, 85 years old. My family on my back, so outlast everybody on my bigger face. Don't know me now, then you never know me.
As the voice of New York Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani, when he was going by Mr. Cardamom. That is his 2019 track, Nani. The video version of it starred Madhur Jaffrey. All right, John Nichols, you got cut off just as you were talking about the platform that Mamdani ran on, and particularly the fact that he decided in the most heavily Jewish city in the country to carve out a resolutely anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinian position over Gaza, stuck to it, and engaged with his critics over it. I mean, he went into the synagogues, into the congregations, into not just the progressive Jewish groups that were already protesting the genocide, but, you know, leaned into discussing, debating, and listening to the people who disagreed with him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think this is important. Zoran Mamdani put his faith in the whole of New York, including its Jewish communities. And he said, look, I want to talk to you about where I stand on this issue. We may not always agree, although what he found is a great deal of agreement, especially from younger voters. But what he said was, I want to engage with you. I want you to know that if we disagree, that won't change my absolute commitment to making this a safe and livable city for you. And what was striking about that was that instead of being defensive about his own position, he was confident in where he stood, but he was also respectful of the debate, respectful of the dialogue. And in covering this race, I was powerfully struck by how many people who disagreed with Zoran Mamdani on a particular issue, be it, you know, foreign policy or domestic, down to, you know, basics in the city. People who disagreed with him, who met with him and said, look, you know, we've got our differences, but this guy's really open. This guy wants to talk. He wants to engage. And at the end of the day, what you saw was a fascinating thing. There were many, many people who, after meeting with Mamdani, as he worked the city on a, like a almost 24/7 basis, who did endorse it. But there were also a lot of people who disagreed with him, but they didn't endorse Cuomo. They didn't endorse his opponents. And I think that really created a lane, which allowed him to close incredibly successfully as somebody who was hit very, very hard by billionaire attack ads and things like this, but who never lost sight of his own desire to unite an incredibly big, incredibly diverse city. And, of course, that's going to be his challenge now that he's mayor, to continue that sort of communication, that sort of connection. But if he does it, I do think Mamdani has the ability to be a mayor much like Fiorello LaGuardia back in the 1930s, who also ran against the establishment and yet ultimately was very successful in uniting the city.
It also seems like a real test of several political theories about how the left can contend for power. I mean, the consultant class would have you believe that the best course of action for a Democratic candidate is to like carefully read the polls and then adopt political positions that align you with the majority position on each issue that gets polled. And I think the problem with that is that voters can smell insincerity. And so the counterposition would be, it is better to run on things you believe on the theory that in those instances where that puts you on the outs with majority opinion, you get more respect from being someone who has principles the electorate can live with than with someone who can't be counted on to stick to anything.
I think that's very well said, Brian. And I might add one counsel to it. You and I have discussed in the past the collapse of our local media in much of the country. Now, New York still has a lot of local media, but really all over this country, including New York, we have situations where voter expectations have been so lowered by the political class, by a lot of our media, by pundits, by everybody who says, you know, you have to operate in this very narrow zone. So when you go out and boldly talk about doing more, you are expanding the discussion. You're giving people permission to, you know, to imagine something much bigger, much bolder than what they've dealt with up to that point. Now, yes, some people may disagree and some people may, you know, really struggle even to, you know, think, is this possible? Could a city be that much on the side of the working class, et cetera, things of that nature. But if you take that risk, if you will, and say, look, I'm pretty confident that if I go out and talk to a lot of people about fast and free buses, about, you know, freezing rents, about universal child care, about, you know, feeding people who live in food deserts. I mean, that instead of rejecting you, they're going to say, wow, we can do that. Okay, let's try.
Yeah. He was also very good at explaining his positions. I mean, I've seen other politicians get jammed up over the question of free transit. He's able to go, look, Staten Island Ferry's free. It's been free for its entire existence. You all ride it. Why are we even discussing this like it's pie in the sky?
You're right. That's exactly the way to say it. And the other thing he did, which I think was lost on a lot of the national coverage, but really important, is he reached out to the multiracial, multi-ethnic immigrant communities of the city where they lived. He ran a multilingual campaign that made sure that he wasn't just talking to the traditional voter, you know, like the regular every election voters, but to people who might be drawn into the politics of the moment. I think that's a big part of why he saw the boost in turnout. He also did one other thing, which was he talked to people where they worked, and he put a lot of emphasis on putting the city on the side of small businesses, of people with street cards, things of that nature. And I think that genuinely built out the coalition from a traditional progressive Democratic coalition to a coalition that did include a lot of small business owners.
Do you think the kind of campaign he ran would be possible in a place that did not have New York City's extraordinarily generous public financing system for campaigns?
That is a super important question, Brian. And I think it would be harder. Not impossible, because Bernie Sanders in his 2016 and 2020 campaigns showed that you can, with the right social media, with the right message, with the right outreach, raise a tremendous amount of money from small donations. And so that can offset the big money that might come in against a Mamdani-like candidate running in another city, for instance, or in another place. But New York has two political reforms, if you will, that are super important. One, a public financing system, which Mamdani relied on and which was very, very good, you know, provided him with enough resources that in combination with a volunteer base that was huge, could get the message to the voters. So that was important. Also, in the primary for the Democratic nomination, they had ranked choice voting. What that means is that people could rank their choices and then transfer votes if their candidate didn't do well. That benefited Mamdani as well. So some structural things are there. The final thing is that on Tuesday in New York, they have fusion voting. And that means that you can run on different party lines and then fuse your votes into a total. And so Mamdani was on the ballot as the Democratic candidate, also as the Working Families Party candidate. In this case, he won big enough that, you know, I think, you know, there's pretty clear he's going to win anyway. But that fusion voting also does sometimes and can benefit progressive.
For instance, in the case of someone who took the position, and to be clear, I'm not advancing this position, who took the position, I cannot vote for a Democrat while they are the party of genocide in Gaza. In New York, they had the option to vote for Zohran Mamdani on the Working Families line.
That's exactly right. That's one of the reasons why the Working Families Party exists. They have many reasons for existence. But one of them is to give voters who are dissatisfied with the Democrats an opportunity to, you know, vote on a different line. It's also to put pressure on the Democrats. If a candidate gets a lot of votes on the Working Families Party line, that's a message to the Democratic candidate, no matter what, you know, their stances are, that they have to listen to progressives. They have to listen to people on the left. And so I think fusion voting, you know, we could do a show on it someday, Brian. It's a very, very useful means means of opening up our politics. But anyway, bottom line is New York City has, and New York has, a number of these structural realities that I think certainly helped Mamdani. But at the end of the day, his win was big enough that I think there's a good chance that he unlocked things that are transferable, ideas, approaches, to other cities, to other places, even if they don't have these structural benefits.
The single transferable vote, or instant runoff voting, in this case, that's a more ambiguous political structure, I think. We have in a lot of municipalities around here. You hear it often get pitched as a way to help the political fortunes of moderates because they will not risk being picked off by extremists in partisan primaries before it goes to the general ballot.
Mm-hmm. That is, look, I gotta be honest with you. Ranked choice voting, we're about to see its play out in, I believe, Minneapolis, in the mayoral race there. And it can produce a lot of different results. One of the things, and again, we've got other races to talk about and other things going on here, but what I would say is that what's important is there are structural reforms that can create avenues by which more voters can be drawn in, and we can get, ultimately, we can try to get a reflection of where the majority of voters are at, where they, what they want, even if they might have to compromise a little bit one way or the other, but to get to something that's a relative reflection of where voters are at. At a time when Donald Trump is trying to redraw congressional district lines everywhere, and there's, all this battling, basically over democracy, it's important to remind folks that there are reforms, ranked choice voting, fusion voting, public financing of elections, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that can expand the promise of democracy and get us to what, ultimately we want, which is elections that reflect the sentiments of the great mass of people who cast ballots. In New York, I think they have made a number of these reforms. And I think on Tuesday, you got a clear reflection of where the majority of people in the city are at, and where they're at is with Zohran Mamdani, their new mayor.
John Nichols, we've talked about the campaign. We have talked about the enabling conditions and political structures in New York City that make it a bit of an exception in New York politics. We have not yet begun to talk about the rest of the country. And I am very cognizant of the fact that we only booked you to be on for two more minutes. Are you free for another half hour? We can change our plans for the second half of the show and maybe bring in some listener calls if you're available.
If you are up for it, brother, let's go for it. Because you and I have been together on many a day after an election. We've done many of these postmortems. It is rare where you have an opportunity to talk about such a clear message coming out of an election, and frankly, such a clear message on the side of the forces who would like to prevent Donald Trump from taking this country in a very dangerous direction. So, let's keep talking.
All right. That is the voice of John Nichols. He is executive editor of The Nation. You just got invited into our guest booking process. He's now our guest for the rest of the hour. We're going to talk about Proposition 50, what it means for redistricting fights in other states in the year ahead. We are going to talk about Democratic victories in many of the political battleground states that will shape the makeup of the Senate after the next midterm elections and pick the next president for the United States. And we will try to take some of your calls as well, because I'm sure a lot of you have smart things to contribute or ask about. So we will continue with John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation, in just a few minutes here at KPF.
I am with you. I apologize. No, I'm here.
Oh, we've all fumbled our hold button, John. Go ahead.
No. I think I might have been on mute too, listening to the news. But so the answer to your very well stated question is yes. I think it does have an influence on the rest of the country. California does count slowly, but I think you're headed towards something like a 70-30 split, which is an overwhelming majority, a landslide, for a proposal that initially started with a lot of questioning, a lot of uncertainty. People, even on the side of Newsom, saying, boy, is he pushing too far here? Is this too complicated? Are they asking voters to, kind of take something on that really requires several leaps of faith? And it just worked. It was very successful. And the basic concept was to say, do you want to push back against Donald Trump? Do you want to push back on behalf of, broader democracy in the United States and voters in California, by all evidence that, we'd love to do that. We're on board. And I do think that that's going to influence Democrats in other states. What I would suggest is that California is the beginning of a pushback against Trump's efforts to warp the maps. Obviously, Trump got what he wanted from Texas, a shift of 5 Democratic seats toward the Republicans. Then a lot of other states jumped in, including Ohio is looking at a redraw, Indiana looking at a redraw, Missouri looking at a redraw, perhaps several others. But what we've already seen, Maryland propose a something at their state level to do a pushback. There is some talk about New York, and I think many of the results there in New York might encourage the Democrats there. But I think the most interesting thing is something that hasn't been written or talked about a lot, and that is that in several of the states where the Republicans are trying to redraw districts to create more Republican districts, they have something which is referred to as a people's or a voter's override, i.e., you can go out and collect hundreds of thousands of signatures, put a referendum on the ballot. That puts a hold on the change that is being made. So they have such a thing in Ohio. If it works out, there'll be some wrangling about this, but if it works out, they might be able to put the Republican gerrymander on hold until voters can address it. Something similar could happen in Missouri. What I think California has done is say to people in state, you know, Democrats, progressives in states like Ohio and Missouri and that, yeah, go for it. You know, get out there on the streets with your petitions, see if you can, you know, block these attempts by the Republicans to gerrymander. And so I think the California results are a very important one in that regard. We still, and again, we're talking about races today. You can do a whole important show on this. We've still got the Supreme Court threat to the Voting Rights Act, which could have an impact as well. But the bottom line is that I think there's a lot of encouragement for Democrats on pushback here. I also think the overall results from the country suggest the possibility that if things keep going in the way that they are, not the certainty, but the possibility that you could have a sufficient blue wave in 2026 that even if Trump tries to manipulate the maps, that with California's move and a few others, ultimately the wave will be more than sufficient to shift control of the House of Representatives to the Democrats.
Well, this is kind of an interesting feature of how partisan congressional district mapmaking works. If you look at the new gerrymander in Texas, you maximize your seats by making the district that your party controls relatively close and the ones that your opponents control overwhelmingly in their favor, so that there's a lot of people wasting their votes in the Democratic district. But if you've decided that your safe margin is like a 7 or 8 point partisan registration advantage in a district, and then you have a wave election that shifts voting turnout by 8 or 9 points, suddenly your gerrymandered districts go the other way.
Yep, you nailed it. That's exactly what we're looking at here. And I, you know, we have two elections and two contests in a number of the states that are in play other than California. But one state that isn't necessarily in play at this point, but is a good bellwether for, you know, pretty much traditionally red states, traditionally Republican-leaning states, is Georgia. They had stunning results out of Georgia last night in state public service commission elections, which Democrats have lost a lot for a long time. They won. And you saw massive shifts for the Democrats in counties that are, you know, quite red, very Republican. You actually had Democrats winning, sometimes for the first time in decades. And so what we're seeing is a phenomenon with boosted turnout that the gerrymanders, the traditional expectations go to the side. That's what happened last night, and it happened all over the country. Whether that can be replicated in 2026, you know, look, it's a year away. It's a long fog, and we are dealing with Donald Trump, whose small-D Democratic instincts are pretty aggressive. So you can't count on things. But what Tuesday's results from all over suggested is that, yes, Brian, you're right. You could see 7, 8, 9, 10-point shifts in some red districts. And so even Trump's gerrymander in Texas could in some instances be upended.
Yeah, those Public Service Commission results in Georgia, because they're statewide offices, they are going to have Senator John Ossoff, who is up for re-election next year. He's a Democrat and considered one of the most vulnerable Democrats in the Senate in the next midterm election cycle. They're going to have him breathing a lot easier. Okay,
I think
John, I want to...
a very large smile on his face,
Yeah, I want to pause for a second, invite our listeners into the conversation. We're discussing yesterday's election results with John Nichols from The Nation. There's a race you've been watching that we haven't discussed and you would like to chime in on, 1-800-958-9008. Or if you've got a question for John Nichols, 1-800-958-9008. And John, we've been having almost weekly conversations about the government shutdown that is now the longest in U.S. history as of today. I am wondering what you think the mandate that came out of voters yesterday, the signals it sends about the unpopularity of Donald Trump and Republicans who go to the ballot, what that does to the dynamics in negotiating an end to the shutdown.
I actually think it complicates things, and I'll tell you why. I think that there is a kind of an exhaustion with the shutdown that was beginning to set in on the part of not just Republicans, but also Democrats. And I think there has been in the last couple of days a lot of talk about movement towards some sort of compromise that would be very unappealing. And so for Democrats now, who some of whom might have been inclined towards such a compromise, they've suddenly got a really powerful signal from their base that people want to fight, people want to push back, and also that the Democratic position on the shutdown hasn't harmed Democrats at all. In fact, you know, Democrats are doing very, very well. So I do think there'll be in the next hours some assessment here by the Democrats of, are they in a stronger position in negotiations now with not so much Trump, but with Republicans in the Senate and to some extent in the House? Because suddenly the Democrats can look at their Republican counterparts and say, you know, look, you want to push this thing. We're willing to keep pushing back. And you're going to have to face voters who the evidence from Tuesday suggests might be prepared to punish you. Not just on the shutdown issue, but on the broader agendas of the Republican Party since Trump has returned to the presidency. That could have an impact. It could shift some things. But I don't know that. I've been talking to members, and I hear a lot of conflicting messages. I do think that the most significant thing on the shutdown so far is that Republicans in the Senate have pushed back against Trump's desire to get rid of the filibuster. And it's notable that Trump made a hard push to get rid of the filibuster right before these off-year elections. My sense is that he anticipated that there might be signals that he didn't want, and he wanted to, you know, get a restructuring of how you vote in the Senate that might be beneficial to his position. I think the Senate Republicans are now going to be more determined to keep the filibuster rules in place. And so in that regard, Trump is weakened to some extent by these election results, because I do think Senate Republicans are not going to be as inclined to adopt approaches that Donald Trump tries to force on them.
I mean, he's polling at near record disapproval ratings. He basically got told to stay out of the Prop 50 fight in California because he could only hurt the no campaign's fortunes. He made a last minute endorsement of Andrew Cuomo, which Zoran Mamdani publicly congratulated Andrew Cuomo on, saying, you've worked so hard for this.
Yeah, Mamdani embraced the Trump endorsement of his opponent, and he also embraced the endorsement by Elon Musk of his opponent. And I think that sort of sums up everything. You also we should keep in note here that in Virginia, in New Jersey, the candidates on the Democratic side, they talked about local issues. They talked about, you know, kind of fundamentals on education and you know, jobs, things like that. But there was a huge anti-Trump overlay in their advertising and campaigning. And that went down, that wasn't just at the top of the ballot. That went down to local races. If you can imagine it, Brian, there were local races for, like, you know, county seats in Pennsylvania and, you know, stuff like that, where candidates were saying, yeah, I care a lot about, you know, roads and, you know, the local issues. But by the way, this is a chance to vote against Trump.
All right. We've got people piling up on our phone lines at 1-800.
Oh, John Nichols. Little clip there. I guess they need to work on their phone interface, but they get a lot of great calls. Brian Edwards Tiekert, the show is up front. It's available as a podcast under that name. He also does something called Corona Calls on Monday. I regularly listen to it. I haven't listened to it this week, but yeah, KPFA product. And I'm going to go back to Amy Goodman here. Momentarily. Again, she was in St. Louis last night screening the film Steal This Story, Please, Open the Limits of Allowable Debate. Going to be in Amsterdam, I noticed, from their itinerary, and she's been saying she's going to make it to Brazil for the COP conference. I'm going to make some remarks about climate and what it's been doing in the way of disrupting people's lives in various places. And we're getting a little bit of it here now. Actually, it's kept the hurricanes off of the mainland of the U.S. So I guess we count that in our favor. Oh, well, climate chaos. Do a WEFT announcement. WEFT denim shirts for pre-order only. We won't be getting these in stock. We'll be getting the ones that you order, small through extra large. It's getting to be time for denim and long sleeve shirts, finally. I picked some green peppers the other day that were hiding in my bushes. I didn't know I had. On the 4th of November, picking green peppers. To place an order, you can send an email to stationmanager@weft.org or call the main number, and you can leave a message there. Somebody will probably get back with you. The deadline is for November 21st. They're very nice looking. If you like the rock that denim look. I'll mention again, of course, views and opinions are those of the speakers. Was thinking about playing a little bit of another web exclusive, part two, with a Palestinian gay activist. I forget the name of his book. He was interviewed on the air, and then they did a side. I might be playing that tomorrow, depending on what else comes up in the world. I'll be around through the labor hour, and it's a wide-ranging discussion. Gus Wood is off in Pittsburgh working on union education. Stephanie will be in, and I'll be running the board and my mouth with her. We're going to go back over some labor history notes. There's a syndicated program available through Pacifica, 2 minutes of labor history. Should be dropping that in somewhere. But it's just another detail somebody would have to deal with. But Stephanie used to originate those when she worked in Chicago. All right. Weye Selinke is the man. He was interviewed on the air, and then an off-the-air interview. One of the questions about going into Nigeria, guns blazing, from Trump over the killing of Christians. There is a thing that's all through the Sahel, a phenomena of Muslim sort of herders. They live with their animals. They graze through regions. And Christians who are more, not pejorative, but sedentary, they're farmers. There's a conflict over territory and land, and that's because of the shrinking or the expanding desert and the shrinking arable land. That's a structural thing that's going on, and it pits Muslims against Christians, not because of their ethnicity or religiosity. It's because they're fighting over the same turf. Not a dimension that gets mentioned, so I decided to mention it. It doesn't come up in this interview, I don't think, either, but the great literary. And again, we won't have time for all of this because I've run long, as I usually do, but you can hear the whole thing at the splash page. Look for web exclusives, and also look for the Palestinian second part of the interview. Radio Free Labor coming up, and I'm doing another 3-hour stint here at the WEF studios, so bear with me.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue now with part two of our interview with Wole Soyinka, the acclaimed Nigerian playwright, author, and poet. He was the first African to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986. He is arts professor of theater at NYU Abu Dhabi. We contacted him to respond to President Trump's threat this weekend to strike Africa's most populous country, the largest oil producer in Africa. In a post on Truth Social Saturday, Trump wrote in part, quote, "The USA will immediately stop all aid and assistance to Nigeria, may very well go into that now disgraced country, guns a-blazing. If we attack, it'll be fast, vicious, and sweet, just like the terrorist thugs attack our cherished Christians," Trump wrote. Thank you so much, Professor Wole Soyinka, for staying with us from Lagos, Nigeria. Before we talk more about the U.S. stopping you from coming to the United States, acclaimed, world-acclaimed writer and poet, if you could respond again to that quote that we started with in part one of our discussion, saying that the U.S. might attack Nigeria, guns a-blazing, and the attack would be vicious and sweet.
You see, I'm a teacher of language, a user professionally of language, and I tell you, I was stopped short when I read that quote. But not surprised, I've heard that kind of language before. I've heard it from Idi Amin, If you check the documentaries on Idi Amin, you'll find that he uses just that kind of combination of appalling language of intent frequently. In fact, it was second nature to him, and he used to fulfill those threats. I recall one interview when he had decided to do what Trump has been doing lately, which is to find scapegoats and throw out those who can be held responsible for the economic problems of the United States. I remember once it was asked, if the Asians, whom you've given, I think it was 80 days or 60 days to leave Uganda, if they refuse to leave, what are you going to do? He said, ha, you will see that they are sitting on a fire, I promise you. I remember that quote, you know, not exact, but that's it. And it was like you just superimpose the image of Donald Trump over Idi Amin. And believe me, there is absolutely no difference. I'm not even going to go into issues of Donald Trump's interview where he said he likes war. He said he enjoys war. And it's clear he's dying to make war. He says he wants to help Nigeria. Of course, anybody, any leader, any nation would gladly accept assistance from anywhere to get rid of this vicious fundamentalist group whose principle, whose understanding of their religion is just to butcher others who happen not to follow them. So they are there as the enemy. At the same time, there has been partnership between Nigeria over regimes for weaponry, equipment, training to deal with these well-organized and transnational killers under the name of Islam. They exist. And what Trump should do is just come down from his high horse and negotiate with those who have a similar problem. And then let their own personnel handle that problem. It's an internal, but at the same time, of course, international, but they're responsible for their own borders. Some fail, others just find that the failure has resulted in a near intractable issue. If Donald Trump is serious, he can put on a Nigerian uniform and join the Nigerian army as an advisor, maybe, because he's never really seen war, has he? But as advisor, you know, and I think Nigerians would appreciate that. But yeah, to use language like invading the sovereignty of a nation, guns blazing, sweetly, viciously.
It's interesting you should have compared Trump to Idi Amin. You called him a white Idi Amin. Because Idi Amin, in addition to being brutal and killing so many Ugandans, was responsible for the expulsion of Indian Ugandans. And when you look at the parallel in the United States of ICE's crackdown on immigrants in this country.
Well, you know that even though I'm in Abu Dhabi, I've been teaching, at least for now, I don't know how long that'll last. His long reach extends even beyond the U.S. borders. But right now, as a member of faculty, I get reports. I've seen reports. I've seen videos of the activities of Donald Trump's ICE. His activity in this respect even reminds me of yet another dictatorial phenomenon, Papa Doc Duvalier of Haiti, who used to send his zombies, the equivalent of ICE, in the streets, into people's homes. He used to believe very much in supernatural powers, but he used the standard means of eradication of supposed critics, the scapegoated individuals, institutions. He's been after institutions. It's obvious this man hates learning institutions. It's not just me saying. Members of my Nobel caucus have written. I remember reading a very thoughtful and pained article by winner of the Nobel Prize in chemistry, who used to be in an authoritarian nation where what's going on in the United States was what took him out of his former Eastern European country. I mean, that's a sad come down for the United States America. Well, we don't on that account say that the USA is a disgraced country. No, we distinguish between an international phenomenon and the means, the access to empowerment of those enemies of humanity, wherever they are. And we don't just condemn the country absolutely because of that trial of their integrity, of their humanity. No, we just know that this problem exists and there should be collaboration in eliminating that issue.
If you could give us more context for people who don't understand what's happening in Nigeria. I mean, it's very interesting that Trump should say we're going to go in guns blazing, shocking many this weekend, as he also desperately seeks the Nobel Peace Prize, a Nobel Prize, something that you did receive, not the Nobel Peace Prize, but the Nobel Prize for Literature. But I'm wondering if you can give us even more context to what's happening in Nigeria. Reading from Al Jazeera, Nigeria, a country of more than 200 million people, is divided between a largely Muslim north and mostly Christian south. Armed groups have been engaged in a conflict that's been largely confined to the northeast of the country, which is majority Muslim and has dragged on for more than 15 years. But so interesting that with groups like Boko Haram killing so many, but so many of them, because it's in northern Nigeria, are actually Muslim.
No, and I think there is also, there's also, many people think it's insignificant, but there's also a third, shall we say, a third religious grouping, which is what we call traditional religions. They exist, and they intersect. You'll find Muslims who actually also secretly go the traditional way. You have Christians who go to church on Sundays and on traditional days also go and worship their gods and their system of accessing and identifying with universal spirituality. Those also exist. But you're right, historically, and this is from historical factors, you'll have far greater Muslims in the north, and in the south you have far more numerous Christians. That is true. But it doesn't mean that other factors, like even ethnicity, access to food, for instance, the clash between the farmers and the herders, I think something which the United States also went through in its its coming in being as a nation. And you have those, and they can be very, they prove to be very, very, very vicious. But because the herding community, the herding, the cattle culture, is more prominent in the north, it gets conflated even among the followers with one religion. In other words, when people see a cattle herder, automatically it's assumed that this must be a Muslim. And very often, broad lines, this is not totally inaccurate. But where you find the physical conflict, it becomes a little bit more confused. The Middle Belt region, for instance, even where we have the Tivs, this largely is also a Christian belt, largely. But when the Fulani identify with husband animal husbandry, when they then even begin to penetrate, kidnap, rape, and kill in the south, then we are confronted with a truly national issue, not just a sectional one. And it should be addressed in that way, as a mixture of many factors, not simplistically. To say, okay, Muslim, Christian, and these ones are here, and these ones are there. The Muslim, the Muslims also have suffered at the hands of Boko Haram and Islam. I mean, at a certain stage in certain areas, Muslims were forbidden even to worship, were forbidden to obtain or to pursue children, not allowed to go to Western schools. In other words, there's also the sense of Western civilization and Arabized kind of culture. It's a potpourri. For me, it's an issue of, are there laws or not? Is there a constitution? Is there criminality in kidnapping, in rape, especially school children being kidnapped and taken into the bush and then shared among these bandits? We call them bandits, taking the name of religion. In being, whoever they are, there's got to be an enforcement of the law, provision of security. This is where a number of leaders have failed in Nigeria.
And if you can talk about the role of the United States in Nigeria. I mean, interestingly, you yourself were imprisoned for several years in the 1960s. And then in, 77 to 79, you were charged with treason in absentia by the General Sani Abacha, the dictator at the time. But the role the U.S. has played in supporting Nigerian dictatorships and where it stands today in the so-called war on terror, providing funds to the Nigerian government.
This is what is so galling for me personally, and for those of my own religious persuasion internally, what we've undergone at the hands of brutal leadership, which led to some of us taking refuge elsewhere. Where did I take refuge? In the United States. I had a choice, actually, between France and a couple of other places, but for a number of reasons, convenience, association, language, I came to the United States. And I was received and protected there. I recall a few times when I received a message from the U.S. maybe internal department, I don't know, asking me to watch my steps, that it was Sonny Abacha at the time, that he was setting up posts to deal, like possible eliminate with political opponents. That was the time when I was declared wanted, dead or alive.
Oh, there's a sobering note to end on. That's Wole Soyinka from the Web Exclusive, and he did talk about this dynamic between the farmers and the herders, the Fulani tribe, or the Muslim nomadic, and there is a conflict implicit in the shrinking of land availability because of climate change. Nigeria is far from the Sahel, but yeah, the